Dr. William Luther Pierce, 2002. How it fits together.
Hello. We've talked about many subjects on these American Distant Voices programs, but one theme which has appeared in nearly every program has been the role of the Jews, either in our history or in our lives today. To a certain extent, that's been unavoidable because of the influence they have over current events through their control of the mass media and because of their historical role in communism. But it's more than that. What I've said in one way or another on several programs is that the Jewish role in our lives goes far beyond the fact that their control of the news and entertainment media gives them a big influence on popular culture and on the political process. Today I want to talk again about this Jewish role. I want to try to give you an overview of it first. There are about 14 million Jews in the world today, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica yearbook for 1997. Nearly half of those, about 6 million, are now in North America, where they make up just over 2% of the population, but wield far more influence than any other group. The world's 14 million Jews think and act like one big family, even though, like most families, they do a lot of arguing and squabbling among themselves. They go to different synagogues, Orthodox and conservative and Reform, or to no synagogue at all. There are atheist Jews, and there are Jews who have converted to Christianity. There are capitalist Jews and communist Jews, homosexual Jews and heterosexual Jews. There are rich Jews and middle-class Jews and even a few poor Jews. But despite this apparent diversity, they do a better job of cooperating with each other and looking out for their common interests than any other ethnic group in the world. Why is this? Why are Jews more racially conscious than anyone else? Why are they so much more ready to collaborate with each other than members of other groups? Part of the reason is in their religion. It is an ethnocentric religion, a racist religion. Whereas Christianity and Islam, for example, are universalist religions, religions for anybody who chooses to believe in them, Judaism is not. Judaism is a religion only for the chosen people, only for the circumcised sons of Abraham. Jews are defined in terms of their bloodline, not in terms of their faith, which is why non-religious Jews like Freud or Trotsky or even Marx, the father of atheistic communism, are considered just as much Jews as the most pious synagogue goer with side locks and yarmulke. The non-religious Jews don't believe the hocus-pocus in their Torah or Old Testament, but they nevertheless are steeped in the folklore and traditions of Judaism. They are as familiar as their religious cousins are with the claims that Jews are a chosen people, destined to own all the world's wealth and be waited on hand and foot by non-Jews. And they are familiar with the tales of persecution from the time of the pharaohs until the time of Hitler, with the tradition of being universally hated by all the other peoples of the world, which is why they believe they are justified in avenging themselves on non-Jews whenever they have the opportunity. I'll not spend any time quoting Bible verses to you today, but if you doubt what I've just told you about the religious basis for Jewish ethnocentrism, just read the Old Testament, especially the five books of Moses and the book of Isaiah. Study them carefully. Even the Bowdlerized King James translation is pretty clear. If you really want to rub your nose in this subject, do some browsing in the Talmud. This tendency of the Jews to stick together, always to favor their fellow Jews over non-Jews, and to work for the interests of their tribe instead of just for their individual interests, is a fact, a very enviable fact. It is the primary reason for their extraordinary level of wealth and power through the ages. You know, there are clubby little groups of white men who cooperate with each other to advance their interests. But those interests are personal and individual, not racial or even tribal. And virtually all of the really influential groups of this sort, the Council on Foreign Relations, for example, or groups of very rich and powerful men, corporate bosses or bankers, are in fact heavily larded with Jews. They're not racial groups at all, even if they don't have any blacks or Chinamen in them. They're simply special interest groups, whereas the 14 million Jews of the world form a huge, self-conscious racial interest group. They really are unique in this regard. I wish that our people had the same degree of racial consciousness the Jews do. The Jews understand the power of togetherness. Most of our people don't. And this is largely the reason why we're in the mess we're in today. I'll come back to this point in a few minutes. The second thing for us to understand about the Jews is their very unusual mode of existence, living nearly everywhere as a small minority among other peoples. If one looks at their history in the biblical period, they were at most times a people on the move, living as strangers and aliens among other peoples, getting kicked out of one place after another, always on terms of enmity with the Gentile host population. Only for a little over 400 years, from approximately the time of King David until the Babylonian conquest, did they really have a national existence in the ordinary sense of the word, with geographical borders. When the Babylonians dispersed the Jews throughout the Middle Eastern and the Mediterranean world in the middle of the 6th century B.C., the Jews adapted amazingly well to being a minority everywhere and a majority nowhere. 500 years later, in the 1st century B.C., the Greek writer Strabo commented, quote, "The Jews have penetrated every country so that it is difficult to find any place in the world where their tribe has not entered and become dominant," end of quote. Note those words. There is no place where they have not become dominant. The great geographer and historian Strabo was not the only scholar of the ancient world to make that observation about the Jews. The Jews became dominant by accumulating a substantial portion of the wealth of every country that they infiltrated. And they accumulated their wealth by collaborating with each other and preying on the host population. Their collaboration was based on their racial consciousness, on their conviction that they were a distinct and unique people, superior to the people among whom they lived, and deserving of whatever they could take away from their hosts. The Jews in Rome did not think of themselves as Romans who happened to believe in Judaism, but as Jews who happened to live in Rome. And the same for every other country where they lived. With the sort of attitude and behavior the Jews had, they were bound to be hated by everyone, and they reciprocated. The Jews regarded the hatred they had for their hosts as justified, just as they considered deceiving and exploiting their hosts to be justified. But their hosts' hatred of the Jews they regarded as bigotry and persecution. Their history is a chronicle of one persecution after another, right down to modern times. During the Middle Ages, they were kicked en masse out of every country in Europe, repeatedly. They pretend today that this supposed persecution was the result of religious bigotry on the part of their hosts. But in fact, it was simply self-defense on the part of their hosts. The same sort of reaction to their presence that the Egyptians and the Greeks and the Romans and everyone else in pre-Christian times had had. And it was this barrier of hatred between the Jews and the rest of the world which made it possible for them to maintain their identity and their sense of racial self-consciousness. If you want to study some of these details of Jewish history for yourself, there are many good books available. One I have read and found valuable is A History of the Jews by Abram Sakar. That's S-A-C-H-A-R. Sakar was the president of Brandeis University, and of course, he looks at history very subjectively and from a very Jewish point of view. But his history is revealing, and you can find it in most large libraries. Now, this peculiar mode of existence of the Jews I have described changed to a certain extent shortly after the Second World War with the theft of Palestine and the establishment of the new state of Israel on Palestinian territory. Today, one-third of the world's Jews live in Israel, but this is only made possible because the other two-thirds are continuing their existence as parasitic minorities among Gentile hosts. Without a constant supply of money extorted from Germany, the United States, and other countries, Israel could not continue to exist. Israel would have gone under half a dozen times in its warfare with its neighbors during the past 50 years if the United States had not provided massive military and diplomatic support. If all of the Jews in America and Europe sold their television networks and newspapers and film studios and moved to Israel, that flow of blood from their hosts would be cut off, and Israel soon would cease to exist. The third thing we must understand about the Jews is the way in which they maintain their status as the dominant minority among us today. In Strabo's day, it was through their accumulated wealth. They were able to buy influence and special privileges for themselves. It remained that way pretty much for the next 1900 years. Throughout the Middle Ages, they made themselves useful as sources of money to kings and popes and emperors. They would suck the wealth from the host population and then give or lend some of it to the rulers in return for being allowed to keep their privileges. Although they usually were tolerated for their usefulness by the rulers, they were hated intensely by the general population. The Jews bought the tolerance of the rulers, but of course they couldn't afford to buy the tolerance of the people. And so until quite recently, the Jews maintained a separate existence among the host population, often living in ghettos, not mixing socially with their hosts, generally not engaging in the same occupations, and regarded with disdain, if not revulsion, by everyone. The great advantage for our people of this mode of existence was that the damage done by the Jews was mostly economic, although they also caused political mischief when it suited their needs. But they had almost no cultural influence on our people. They didn't write books or plays. They didn't paint or compose music. They didn't clog up our universities. They didn't run for public office. And, of course, they didn't have television studios or newspapers or advertising agencies. And so, to a large extent, they lived their lives and we lived ours. That began changing drastically approximately 200 years ago with the advent of the mass media and mass democracy. And the change accelerated greatly during this century. Jews understood immediately the potential that newspapers and other media gave them for extending their influence from the rulers to the whole population. And democracy made this extension of their influence relevant. Democracy provided the tool for transforming influence into power. I've described on other programs the way in which the Jews acquired control of our mass media and, through the media, control of the political process. And I won't repeat that story today. There is an up-to-date summary of Jewish media control in the National Vanguard Books Catalog, which is available from the sponsor of this program. But I do want to emphasize this very important point. The way in which the Jews maintain their position as the dominant minority in our society has changed. It used to be money lending and bribes, and the pressure was exerted only at the top on the political leaders of our society. Today, it's control of the mass media of news and entertainment, and the pressure is exerted at every level of society. Some people still talk darkly about international Jewish bankers. And of course, there are such animals today, just as there also are international bankers who are not Jews. But the control of the media is the key to Jewish power today, not control of banking. The most important Jews today no longer are the Rothschilds and Warburgs and Hambros and Sassoons, but instead are the Eisners and Levins and Newhouses and Redstones and Bronfmans and Sulzbergers, the Jewish media bosses. So now let's look at the details of the Jewish application of influence through media control. Most people have a very limited range of real-life experiences. Television and films and glossy magazine advertisements provide an enormous expansion of experience for the average person by substituting artificial experiences for real experiences. On the television screen, viewers experience artificial social relationships, artificial romances, artificial conflicts, artificial life. In advertisements, they are given artificial ideals of beauty and fashion, artificial lifestyles to which they can aspire. And in their newspapers and news magazines, they are given a carefully filtered, a carefully slanted view of what is happening in the world. And unfortunately, most people do not have sufficient powers of discrimination to distinguish the artificial world of the media from the real world of everyday experience. The two worlds merge in their minds, and they can't tell them apart. What people see on the television screen is not just entertainment. It is a collection of artificial experiences which merges with their collection of real experiences and gives them a new and largely artificial basis for evaluating things and making decisions. Cleverly designed advertisements don't just show potential customers what is available and give them the information they need to choose what they want. Clever advertising actually creates new wants, new desires that didn't exist before. The advertisements manipulate people's desires and motivations. In a similar way, television entertainment manipulates viewers psychologically. It changes their values and attitudes. It strongly affects the way they see things, including political issues and political candidates. Well, I hardly have to tell you that the modern mass media give enormous power, unprecedented power, to whoever controls them, especially in a democracy. And really, no knowledgeable person who is honest will dispute my conclusion here. There are many people who are not knowledgeable, who believe that they can watch television without being affected by it, who believe that they make up their own minds independently without relying on the artificial reality supplied by television. But most of these people are mistaken, and the experts will agree with me on this. The mass media do shape public opinion, and in a democracy, they do control the political process. So now the only question which remains is this. To what end do the Jews who control the media use their control? What is their aim? What do they want? Now, the politically correct answer is that all the Jewish media bosses want is what any other businessman wants. The media bosses are simply businessmen, and their aim is simply to run their businesses at a profit. Well, I'm sorry, but that simply isn't true. It simply is not a coincidence that everywhere you look in the mass media, you see Jews in control. It's not a coincidence that a group making up only a little over 2% of the population has virtually complete control over the mass media. The unanimity of the mass media on virtually every major issue of our time simply is not a coincidence. It is simply not a coincidence that the media bosses all just happen to have adopted the policy of hushing up black-on-white crime and publicizing as widely as possible any white-on-black crime. All of these things are planned and deliberate. They are the consequence of conscious collaboration. Only a fool can believe that it's all just coincidence. The Jewish media bosses know what they want. It is control, not just of the media, but of us, of everything. They want to own us, and to the extent that they cannot own us, to destroy us. Unfortunately, I cannot play for you a secret recording of one of their summit meetings where they discuss their goals and their strategy, a la the protocols of the Elders of Zion. I can only offer you the historical record and common sense. The record, for those who have the eyes to see and an open mind, is pretty clear, beginning with the account in the book of Genesis of the takeover of Egypt by Joseph and his brothers so they could all, quote, eat the fat of the land, end quote, on through the ages to the Marxist takeover of Russia early in this century and the attempted takeover in many other countries. You know, the Germans didn't begin throwing the Jews out of Germany in the 1930s because of Christian bigotry. It was because they wanted their country back. The Germans wanted to run their own universities and schools, their own newspapers and films, their own legal and medical professions. If you want to understand the historical record, you must study it. I can't go through all of that for you in a half-hour program. I can only point the way. And as for the common sense aspect of understanding what the Jewish media bosses are up to, we just need to clear the cobwebs out of our heads and realize that every racially conscious group strives for mastery, for domination, not just the Jews. That's nature's way. That's the way it is in every barnyard and every schoolyard. And that is why the media propaganda takes the deliberate slant it does, trying to make us feel guilty, trying to kill our sense of racial consciousness while the Jews keep theirs, trying to persuade us to give up our arms, trying to silence all our dissident voices. Their aim is for us to be racially unconscious, for us to be ashamed of our nature and our traditions, for us to be afraid to organize for our common good, afraid of being thought racists. The deliberate aim of the Jewish media propaganda is to disarm us morally, to make us rootless and defenseless, and then to destroy us. That is what is happening now. Think about it, and you'll see how it all fits together. Thanks for being with me again today.